So now you're the breacher, but you don't have to breach. Do you still maintain the number one position?
So this is how we operate too. We do one task at a time, meaning they don't want you to be task saturated. So when we stacked up on the door, cell duty was on one side, I was on the other. The door handle was on his side, which made him the breacher.
Okay.
It wasn't locked, but if it was locked, it would be his problem. So that makes me number one. If the door handle was on my side, I'm now breaching. He's now number one.
Got it.
So walk us through. You're stacked up, and you say you got 10, and that 10 includes your doctor?
Yeah, the 10th one was our doctor.
All right.
So we moved, we made entry, and when we came in, it's a complex structure. So it was built in like 1930, but every time they built a new thing, they just built a new building and connected it. So like one team made entry, we thought we were on the same floor, but they were in the basement, we're on the first floor. So it was just a horrible layout. So when we come in, there was a big sanctuary and I wound up holding on a hallway, and this talks about, so I don't think it was so much, obviously there was adrenaline, but the round in the head kind of messed up a lot of memory. But I remember I was holding on a long hallway with the canine officer Hurley. Well, they cleared a sanctuary and looking through there, I could see people down. There was two people down. And
Tim, real quick, from the point you made entry to the point when the shooting started, how much time had elapsed from when the shooting started to where you guys are at the door going in?
Probably 30, 40 minutes.
Okay.
I don't know the exact time. It was a while.
Because it took you at least 20 minutes to get there from the time of the shooting.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
My team was clearing this big sanctuary, and my team leader, John Craig, Miller was our team leader on that sack, but John Craig found a survivor. Her name's Andrea Wedner. She had been shot. Her mom was shot right next to her. It was pretty graphic. So she had to lay next to her mom until we found her, and John happened to find her. So I remember holding on this hallway, and TAC medics walked her by me, and she got shot in the arm, and they were holding her arm like at a 90. And I just remember her screaming, like, you know what I mean? Like, pain, you could tell. And I was like, you know what I mean? Like, geez. So then I went back to holding on the hallway. And then they came out, and we start moving again. And the other team found another survivor named Dan Legger, who me and him became good friends. We could talk about that after.
And you said two teams. So two teams of 10?
I don't know how many was on theirs. Because, again, I was, you know what I mean? I have to work with them. Eventually, we all meshed together. We all wound up getting together. Cell duty was on the other team. So they were working the basement. We were working the first floor. There was multiple rooms. We had the privilege of training with some military entities and get to pick their brain. So there was some stuff, like they said, like in training, that I actually found useful inside that building. Like, I never thought in my career to freeze an elevator. They were like, always open the elevator, put something in a door so they can't get behind you. And I'm like, man, my whole career, I never thought about that. And how many buildings have I cleared? So me and Miller cleared. And that's one of my vivid memories of that day, is the elevator door seemed like it took a minute to open. And I'm like, he's going to shoot me in the face. Like, I just kept thinking, like, he's going to be in this elevator. And we're both standing there. It was probably 10 seconds, but it seemed like 10 minutes. And then we froze the elevator. And we were finding, like, a trail of breadcrumbs. Like, you know, toppers they put on magazine dust covers?
Yep.
We were finding them. And he was leaving. He even said in his interview, he was leaving the trail. Basically. He's
baiting you guys in.
Correct. So we cleared a bunch of buildings. I did wind up breaching a bunch of doors, just kicking them.
Hey, and talk about that before we get into the shooting. I mean, like you say, this is a huge building and you're operating at such a high tempo, right? I mean, just talk about that, right? Because you're on high alert, adrenaline super high, every door, every corner you slice, right? You're thinking you're going to have to engage.
Yeah, that's, and that's, I said in my interview with the FBI, I said, every room I went in, I expect the contact. You know, I think you're wrong if you don't in that situation. So I can't tell you how many doors I kicked, but they said a lot. me and Burke. Actually, Burke was with us. He just made the team. I was his mentor. He was another breacher. He's a part of this too. So we were clearing like offices and stuff, and then we wound up linking up with the other team. And we go up this, which wound up being the third floor, but at the time I thought it was the second floor. And there's a bunch of classrooms. So we'll throw this in before we get any further. He was an hour early. So why everybody was so old is the older Jewish people had a tradition. So they would go an hour before and do their thing. And then everybody would come an hour later. So he came at 9, everybody went there at 10. And the classroom he set up the ambush was, they would have children, like a class in their dorm, because their ceremonies, whatever, I might use the wrong word, but it's 3 hours long. So they would have like a daycare, and there actually would have been 50 kids in the room that he held up in. So, but one Saturday a month, they don't do it. And it just happened to be that Saturday. So we're clearing, and we're getting his classrooms, we come upstairs. And I remember one of my teammates, he was a full-timer. He's been on for a long time. He was like reading up a lot of real estate. We're going to run into him because between both teams coming to different things, we did eat up a lot of real estate. And
were you driving him at that point, or was it just a natural process of you're clearing everything and you're going to end up where he's at? Are you trying to drive him?
No.
Is he moving or is he staged up waiting?
We know now he was staged up waiting. He actually set the room up. He put chairs like back one way, back the other way, you know, put boxes on tables, like set up a fatal funnel. So as we're getting closer, we're going up this flight of stairs. Our incident commander inside the building asked, is there any canines? And there's canines attached to us. We do train with them. And the handler was in the building, but left his dog in the car. So, and then he asked again for technology. We call technology robots. We have a big robot, but we have little ones. We call them throwbots. You could throw them and they land upright. No, camera, you could see in the room. Equipment trunk, everyone trying to run in a fight. No one grabs a camera. So to like the last radio transmission, he says, you know, based on priorities life, we're going to continue to push. So that's at the point where cell duty is at the door. And he was asking me if I was ready. And, you know, I gave him a head nod. Yeah. And he popped the door. So when a door opened, I took a quick step in the door to see if I can engage anything from the outside. And it was pitch black in there, pitch black. And the room opened up to the left, so there was a wall to the right. So I start working along wall, trying to get to the corner. And he ideally, cell duty would have worked the left, and then Miller would have took the middle. Well, I got a couple feet in the door. I don't know how far, 10, 12. And the first shot hit me in my left, in my right kneecap. And I remember that because it felt like there was no pain. It felt like I got cut in football or a dog ran into my legs. Like it just took me off my feet. I was trying to get behind me. Even cell duty was like, he kind of knew the direction he was because you were trying to get there and then you just dropped. And I think, I don't know the order, but talking to Mike, I think the next round hit me in the head, and that round went through my helmet, hit me in the head, wound up fracturing my skull and my jaw, but I think it knocked me out. In my mind, I was laying on the floor in the calmest, darkest place ever. And then I felt something fall on me. Like, you know, if you play football, or you just pow on people. I just felt something fall on me. I didn't know who it was, but I knew something fell on me. And it wound up being cell duty. He actually jumped on me to put body armor between me and the shooter because he said he was watching rounds, like my pants rip open and me getting hit. So when he fell on me,
when you say you got shot, you were wearing a Kevlar helmet? I take it at the time, right? The round hit the Kevlar helmet.
It punched right through.
But had it not been for that, you would have taken a round directly to the side of the head.
Absolutely, yeah. Again, the city's infinite wisdom, they didn't buy the rifle-rated helmets. They only bought pistols. So, and I said it down there, if anybody knows a 3M helmet rep, I'll sell their helmets all day long. Because it was about 10 feet away, and I'm here. You know, it did punch through. It did its job. It slowed it down. So
What caliber was it he fired at you?
So I got hit with both the 223, and then he ran out of 223 ammo, and I took some 357 SIG rounds. So he transitioned.
Okay. Okay.
So kind of, if you're going in the door, like you say, you know, we kind of divide the room up. Where's he hiding at from the door?
So we didn't know the room. I wound up being kind of L-shaped. So there's speculation he started off laying down because there was rounds going up through a table. And there was a filing cabinet that was just offset a little bit. So it wasn't, you know what I mean? It wasn't a square room. There was a little cut up where he was back in the corner.
So it was a pitch black room, but you guys had flashlights on your weapons?
Yes. I did not have an opportunity to use mine. Mike and Miller both said by the time they hit their white light from the shooting and drywall, because there was teammates, we had to talk with them about that, decided to shoot through the wall. From the gunpowder, the drywall, he said when he hit his white light, you couldn't see anything. It was like putting your high beams on in fog.
Yeah.
So it really was useless.
So you had other people shooting through the wall into the room while this was going on?
Which is a no-no, but we talked to them about that, and it was just newer people on the team, you know, that adrenaline dump. It's right when there's no operators in the room. If nobody's in the room with a bad guy, by all means, we'll all shoot through the wall and make it safe. But yeah.
But when did you know that you had been shot? Not just something happened, but when did you know that you'd been shot?
So, one, I knew the leg hit me, but when Mike fell on me, and he heard me say this, when he fell on me, I had two thoughts, which sound stupid, but they were my two thoughts. The first thought was, fuck, you just got shot in the head. And the second thought was, you're still thinking, do something. So at that point, I didn't know to the extent, but I knew I was down.
Mm-hmm. What'd you do?
I got off 27 rounds, which I didn't even know I fired till the FBI told me. I keep 28 in my mag. I loaded it. I remember checking it before we moved to make sure it was hot. So my 28th round was on a sidewalk, and I'm always like, what if it's a 28th round that could have ended it? But so I got off my rounds. My rifle at that point got hit and disabled. It broke the gas tube, and one round just knocked off the accessory rail. And by then, my number three, Andrew Miller, was in the room, and he was laying suppressive fire down. And I was able to, Mike was able to crawl out, and I was able to crawl to the door.
You know, and this is not, don't take this wrong. I'm just sitting here. How did this motherfucker survive as much lead that was going in there? He should have fucking played the lottery, because with that much lead going in there, you think he would have been ventilated.
Now, he got hit four times. Unfortunately, you know, if we shoot them, we have to save them. So the same TAC medics that worked on me worked on him. That's nature of our job, which sucks.
Had it not been for medical, were any of the wounds that this piece of shit we don't give airtime to the name, so fuck the guy. Mm-hmm. Would any of those rounds have been fatal had it not been for the presence of medics?
Maybe, because there was, in the crime scene photos, there was a lot of blood where he was at. So he was definitely bleeding pretty good. He probably would have bled out. Also, they were going to throw an IED in the room and end it. And they think he heard the radio chatter of our bomb squad bringing it in. That's why he gave up.
Did you? Now, it's interesting you say that, because I remember the chief of police for Dallas, I think his name was Gregory Brown, or Chief Brown, talked about that's how they ended the shooting. The guy that killed the four officers down there, they put an IED on the end of a robot and blew that fucker up.
Mm-hmm. That's kind of was the game plan.
So you crawled out. They didn't drag you out of there?
No, I got to the door in Burke, and I was like, you're lucky you got hurt trying to save me, because I'm your mentor. He said I was on my hands and knees, and he tried to grab my dead man strap, like on the back of my kit, and he got shot through the wrist. He took a round through the wrist.
Wow.
So when I crawled out of the doorway, my teammates were stacked on the stairs, and they gave me a fast ride down the stairs. They basically just threw me down the stairs to get me down there, because they were still shooting. And then
were you there when he surrendered, or did that happen after you were extracted?
I was sleeping by that time. I was in surgery.
How much longer did this go on? I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, go ahead. Because I got a thought here.
How much longer did this, after you were shot, how much longer did it go before a piece of shit gave up?
It went a little bit more. I don't know exactly, because I know there was a second shootout. He was shooting from deep in the room, out of the room at them, and they were shooting back. So there was another shootout. I'm going to say because Burke, so the hallway was split. Stairs went down and stairs went up, and then it opened to the left. So when Burke got shot in the hand, he went up. Him and cell duty in person went up. And I think they said after 20 minutes of them, you know, they put a tourniquet on him and put his gun in his left hand and told him, you know, get ready to fight. And he was ready. But I think they said it was around the 20-minute mark where he was telling him, listen, I'm gonna pass out. But they couldn't get him past the doorway because they were still shooting. So he gave up right around then, and then they got Burke out. So I want to say it went on for another 20 minutes to a half hour.
Oh, my God, that's a lifetime.
Yeah. He said he was kneeling on his hand trying to stop the bleeding. I mean, he sounded like he had a rough go. But unfortunately, he went up.
And so what I was going to say just a second ago, what a perfect example here of just because you got hit, you're not out of the fight. Nope. You know, the fact that your first thought is, damn, I got shot in the head. But your second thought immediately is, hey, if I'm thinking, I'm still good to go here.
Right.
I just presumed that your buddies had pulled you out of the room. I had no idea that you got yourself out of the room.
So I didn't know. I crawled out of the room until Burke told me, because I was like, well, how did you get shot? Like, talking to the hospital. He's like, well, when I looked in, you were crawling on your hands and knees. I'm like, how was I crawling on my hands and knees? I got shot in both legs and my left arm. And he was like, oh, you were on your hands and knees and I tried to grab you.
It's adrenaline is a strange thing that makes you do things that are like superhuman. You know, and I'm not being facetious when I say that. That's, you see that time and time again. How many times were you hit altogether?
12.
Oh my gosh.
I have 7 holes in my body and 5 more in my kit. And sometimes they bust my balls and say, you can't count the ones in the kit. So, but 12.
So when you say now your kit, you're also talking about you've got plates. You got your plates, right? And that's,
yes.
Those took 5 of those shots.
Yeah. One, the side took one. There was no plate. It was just Kevlar. And that was a 357 SIG, cause it's a perfect 9mm round. Took a chunk out of me. So I took one on the side too.
Okay.
And one on the edge of my back plate, like on the very edge, dead center. I don't even know how I caught it. I lucked out.
Wow. So the 7 that hit you, where were you hit?
Left kneecap. Correction. Right kneecap, left tibia, left elbow, which rode down my arm, shattered my elbow, my ulna. They took the bullet out of my hand, broken knuckle, cut a tenet, the head, and 3 in my butt cheek. My buttocks.
Sounds like Forrest Gump. I got shot in the buttocks, sir.
Well, that's why I got to meet the president, because I got shot in the buttocks.
Did you drop a trowel and show him the wound?
When he came to the hospital, I wasn't allowed to talk because I was on ketamine saying weird shit. So I don't even remember seeing him in the hospital. But I remember him lecture, don't say nothing. I'm like, yeah, whatever.
So episode 8, I think it was, a buddy of mine, Mike Neal. I don't know if you remember seeing video of the shootout with the 2 sovereign citizens in Arkansas that killed the 2 West Memphis officers and that fishing game. Well, that Mike Neal's a buddy of mine. We had him on, and he's at the White House. At that time, Biden was the VP, and he's getting a medal from him. And I was thought he was shitting, but we pull up the video. He actually, when the Biden went around behind him, he felt a little creepy, but he put his hands down. He nut checked the vice president. And you can see it.
That's a good one.
And it is. I pulled up the video. It's on our website. It's on the episode page. It's like, there he is, nut checking the Veep, man.
Yep.
That's great. That's a good one.
You know, I can't tell you, Tim, how amped up it is. You get sitting here listening to you tell the story. I'm sweating like a freaking dog here. And then you turn right around and tell a joke, and that's what lightens everything up.
Right.
You know, I hope our listeners are appreciating what they're hearing here, because this man, you beat death that day, you know, and holy cow, it's, even though we've been out of the job for a long, long time, it's still, you know, it's brother that's been wounded in action here, and your heart still bleeds blue, I guess would be the way you'd describe it. It's just, whew. I mean, I'm glad we're laughing now, because I'm sitting here, I can't get my leg to stop shaking. I'm sweating like a dog, and it's, the air conditioner's on, you know, it's
we're going to have to adjust your meds again, Murph.
Well, it could be it too. I don't know. It's
hey, but and on a serious note though too, we want to, you know, obviously recognize too, there were 11 people killed that day. Yes. And some of them were Holocaust survivors. I mean, can you imagine surviving this shit only to be killed in some place you thought you were going to be safe?
Right.
Right. Do you want to mention them? Or you want me to mention them?
Yeah, you can, Murph.
Okay, so the they're heroes. I mean, these people were doing nothing more than celebrating their religion and being American citizens, were killed by this piece of shit that we will not name. But those killed that day were Joyce Feinberg, Richard Gottfried, Rose Malinger, Jerry Rabinowitz, Cecil and David Rosenthal, Bernice and Sylvan Simon, Daniel Stein, Melvin Wax, and Irving Younger. God bless you. Rest in peace.
Let's talk about the resolution of that day. Now, when you were going in through that, like I said, you saw some folks down. Where was the main action initially? Was it all confined in one area? The active shooter, was it throughout the facility?
It was throughout the facility. The ones I saw were on a stair where they found. So there was a dead female and a dead male, and Dan Legger, the survivor, on the stairs. But I had to step over the two dead to get up the stairs. They found some in the basement, in the kitchen, in the sanctuary. They found some, and then right outside the sanctuary. And then there was a closet downstairs where there was actually three people hiding. And I believe it was Younger was – as he was younger, Wax was in the closet with two other people, and he stuck his head out for some reason. And when he stuck his head out, the shooter shot him. So the two survivors said one, her name was Carol Black, was hiding behind the door. And I guess the shooter actually stepped into the closet. And she said she just tried to get as small as she could behind the door. And the other guy was hiding way in a deep corner. And he said it was too dark, so he couldn't see him. But he actually stepped into that closet, but didn't see them. So they were right there.
Wow.
And address another thing, too, because like we talked about compartmentalization, there was a reason I asked that early. When you get there, and we talked with this, you know, with our buddies from Nashville and stuff, it is the worst thing in the world to see this kind of carnage, you know, right? You know, it's one thing to see one body. It's another thing to see multiple bodies. And you're having to step over people, you know, there's nothing I can do for you. I can't help you, right? And it's even with a survivor, it's like, hey, sorry, pal, that's what we got medics for.
Right.
How do you process it? How do you process that in your mind as you're going through that building? I mean, how do you deal, you know, what's going through your mind when you're stepping over these victims?
Stopping a timeline of violence. That's, you know, that's why I'm there. That's why my team's there. Everyone has a job, and you know, that's being part of a team. Everyone has something to do. When it's time to punt, the punter punts, you know what I mean? When it's time for medics to work, they work. When it's time for us to do a specific task, we're going to do it, you know?
Well, you know, and not to sound cold-hearted, but if you stop to suffer remorse over the people who've already been killed, you're not saving more people. Your job is to get in there and save more people.
Yeah. Because, I mean, obviously, when we start finding people alive, you know, we're like, does he have a hostage? But, you know what I mean? Is there more people? Because they found people hiding in closets. They found people hiding in different places, found two survivors who were shot, you know? So at that point, it's even more important to find him.
Well, and that's why, Murphy, you read my mind. You don't want to make it sound cold-hearted, but it's like, my job is not to stop and check your pulse. My job is to keep moving forward, right? Forward. If you don't move forward, you die. You got to keep moving forward. Take the fight to this piece of shit. How many people were in the congregation that day? When the shooting started?
I don't know the exact number. Like I said, it was a small group of older people who do the traditional thing. I don't know. There is some memory loss with that headshot.
That's so. Okay. No. That's been, like I said, it's based on what there's media reports out there. We're just asking you. Well, let's talk about aftermath. You said that this piece of shit gave up after he may have heard radio chatter like you're going to bring in an IED. I mean, it's like we're going to put an end to this.
Yeah.
But you didn't find out about that till later, right? Because you are, I think you said at this point, you're in surgery.
Yeah, I was. So from the time I went down and got on the first flight of stairs, they dragged me to another flight of stairs. And two medics tried to carry me down that flight. And
good luck with that at 365.
Yeah, no, I took a fast ride down that stairs too. They dropped me. They apologized.
You were getting abused left and right, weren't you?
Not a benefit to be that big. So they start working on me. From the time I went down to the time they were asking for cover to transport me from the building to an ambulance was 3 minutes and like 24 seconds. So it was pretty fast.
They did push you down them steps.
They did. Cut all my clothes off too. They said, teammates were like, I come on a bender laying in your underwear bleeding everywhere. I'm like, yeah, that's okay. Apparently I was yelling at the medics, calling them stupid fucks, telling them tourniquets hurt worse than getting shot. Take them off. They're like, we can't take them off. I don't remember any of that.
This is the second time you've been found fucked and laying on your back, right?
I mean, it's a lot of whiskey. You always wind up like that. You know?
Yeah. Well, first time was going down the steps. Everybody, this time you're at least to the credit of your fellow SWAT team members. They just didn't leave you there on your back as they walked past you.
No. But you know, the surprising thing is one of them didn't pull out a phone and take a picture of you like that.
No, they didn't. And I give them credit too, because they stayed in that fight, you know, after most of them saw me in that condition and Burke shot, you know, they, again, that goes back to, we have a job to do, you know?
Yeah. It's called professionalism.
And then even after it was all said and done, the FBI and their infinite wisdom kept them on scene another 90 minutes. I don't know
why. Kept who on scene?
Everyone that was there, all the SWAT team. In the carnage around the dead people, and for some reason, I don't know. But I know, like, my one teammate was like, I'm not staying. I'm leaving. I'm going to the hospital. And
he left. Just out of curiosity, when did this why – you know, because we had this discussion. So one of the episodes we had is a friend of mine, Ed Davis. Ed was the commissioner of the Boston Police when the Boston Marathon bombing happened. And we talked about, should the FBI come in and take over? Because he actually made an interesting point that if they'd come in and declared it a terrorism event, it would have made null and void much of the insurance that the people had because they weren't insured for acts of terrorism. So in this case, why, if you found out later, I know you didn't know at the time, but is there a reason why the FBI came in and took over so quickly?
They did deem it an act of terrorism.
Okay. So
maybe that's why. The scope of it, I don't think the city could have really did what the FBI did because they got way more, you know, resources. They computer mapped the entire building. They spent a lot of time there, but yeah, they did deem it an act of terrorism. So maybe that's why.
Okay.
Yeah. It was obviously a hate crime.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. There was the biggest attack on the Jewish people on U.S. soil ever.
Yeah. I'm going to make a reference today because people are under the misunderstanding. The number one target of religious attacks, the number one most attacked religious group in the United States are Jews. Mm-hmm. They have the most hate crimes, more than all the other groups combined. That includes Muslims and Christians, you know, and everything in between, right? And this is just another indication of that. When did the compartmentalization start breaking down and you realize I left things kind of bad with the wife? How does she find out?
When I got back in the ambulance, I asked the team doctor. That's when they put another tourniquet on my leg and I got hit with the pain drain. And I was like, I need something, please. And he gave me a shot. And when I woke up in the hospital, my friend John Craig, my TL, was there. And I told him, I was like, whatever Doc Murray gave me made me right as rain. And he was like, what are you talking about? I was like, whatever shot he gave me this morning, he was like, that was 3 days ago. So I was out of it for at least 3 days. So I really don't know. And they had me, I was on a dilaudid button, a ketamine drip. They're giving me oxy. So like there was a period when I was in ICU for 3 weeks. I thought it was 3 days. So I really don't remember when I talked to Jen. I don't know. I know that when I started coming to, you know, we kind of I was kind of a dick at first and kind of remembered the argument and kind of picked it up where I left it off, you know, for a little bit. It was heated. But
can I give you some marital advice? That was not a good move, pal.
Again, I was all, they had me good. I was like, I've seen dragons and weird stuff on ketamine. That's a beast. But,
ketamine, that is, see, we hear so much about that. How was, just out of curiosity, because, you know, I know Murph, you haven't, I haven't never done anything other than a prescription, but what was it like being on ketamine?
So they said that's why I don't remember. So I went back on the doctor's visit to the ICU to thank everybody. And, you know, they're like, who are you here to see? And I'm like, I don't remember. Well, there wound up being 12 people that actually, you know, so carry me over those weeks. And I was like, I don't remember any of it. And the doctor was like, then we did our job. Like, ketamine, you're not supposed to remember. But there was a point where, like, I would close my eyes and the room would turn into a cave and dragons would come out and just weird things. Like, there was one time, if I closed my eyes, it was real bright. But if I opened it, it wasn't. Like, it was, and I would ask him every morning, I would meet with a pain team. And I'd be like, you got to get me off this ketamine. Like, we can't take you off. You're in too much pain. And I'm like, but I'm seeing shit. So they were like, we'll try and dial it back. I mean, thank God for pain meds, you know, because it was to the point where I was in pain, but I was so, they had it so managed that I didn't care, if that makes sense.
You know, pain is a diagnostic tool too. I learned that too from an orthopedic surgeon when I had a broken, you know, bone and stuff. They don't care. I mean, pain's a diagnostic tool, but at some point though, it's hard to recover unless they give you some good pain management, because otherwise you are in pain all the time. Things get more inflamed. It's like, Murph, you know, I know you hate to take that shit, but when you had your knee replaced, did you take a couple pain pills?
Yeah, I took, may have taken four. You know, it's, I think Connie knocked, she got me off the pills the second day.
Yeah.
And it was, but you know, it was tolerable. It was, it hurt like a bitch, but nothing like what Tim went through, I'm sure.
Yeah. But what I'm talking about, but even then you use pain meds to at least get you over that hump, right? You got it. Cause otherwise it's just too unmanageable. You had a long road to recovery though. When is the first time you remember having clarity about what happened? I mean, how long after the event? Was it like a month, 2 months before you came
with in? You? It was a trial. I got to sit in and everyone's testimony because I was a victim. And I was like, man, like all this stuff, there was a lot of questions and the FBI wouldn't answer our questions. Like, they wouldn't tell me if I shot or not. So like, trial answered a lot of questions. So I really didn't grasp everything until trial. There were so many questions.
How long after the active shooting was the trial? How long did it take to go to trial?
5 years.
5 years.
Jeez.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, and how long was the trial?
3 months. It was long. Because they did the three phases. You know, the guilty phase to see if he was eligible for death penalty, and then a death penalty phase.
Yes. Which, you know, we're going to, it's a spoiler alert, son of a bitch got the death sentence, which is not always the case in a federal case. I mean, those, you don't see too many federal cases other than like Timothy McVeigh and folks like that who get the death sentence. Let's hope that justice is swift on this asswipe. Let's talk, well, let's, go ahead.
Well, I'm doing the research. I'm just reading through some notes. And so he was sentenced to death on August 3rd, 2023. And so I guess he's on death row now, but it also found where there's still a bunch of like 36 state charges pending on the guy.
Yeah. The FBI brought that up. I don't get that. Like, I don't know.
I think that's a fail safe in case something happens with the federal case, you've got state charges, but this dude is not getting out of prison.
No, he owned it. You know what I mean? He bragged about it. It's not like he's denying it. And that's what his defense attorneys, basically their opening statement sounded like the prosecution's opening statement. You know, they're like, we're not denying that he did this. They were just trying to get him off the death row.
Mm. Yeah. Well, too bad. They didn't get their job done, which is good for you guys. Well,
hopefully in the next 30 years, he'll actually die for his actions.
I agree.
Unless he gets shanked in prison, that's been known to happen too. Sometimes
shooting a cop. I don't know.
Yep.
He's probably a hero in there.
He could be. But then again, I know that there's some Jewish mafia guys that are doing time. So you never know. Well, let's finish up around this though, because you had a long road to recovery. What was the hardest thing for you about the recovery?
So you mentioned mental health. I hear the story of the weed. So I got into mental health, and the hardest part for me was, and they called it mourning the loss of the old me and learning to love the new me. The physical change in me, you know, from being in the gym and being active and being strong. And I have a lot of limitations now. My arms are different lengths. My elbow doesn't bend all the way. I can't do this with my hand. I can't feel my leg. So a lot of stuff that I did, you know, I can't do. And it was a hard pill to swallow that, you know, physically I wasn't as strong and as what I used to be.
Where are you at mentally? Where are you at mentally?
Ups and downs still, you know.
What's the biggest thing you struggle with from that mentally?
Not being there. So I had my 26th surgery in September. When they get called out and have warrants and stuff, and I still get the alerts, and not being able to be there. I listened to them being two shootouts from my house, which was terrible. When I actually got dressed three times, I'm like, fuck it, what are they going to do? Fire me, but I'm going. I got dressed, undressed. I'm calling people. I'm like, what do you need? I'm coming. And I'm like, man, like, it's just tough being on the bench while they're still out there playing.
I remember when you were doing your talk there in South Carolina, you actually did go out and do a couple things, didn't you?
I hit a door.
With permission or without permission?
Without permission.
How did I know that? How did I know that?
So I came back a couple times, but every time I came back, there was like a hiccup. So they were calling it transitional duty. I could train, but I can't operate. So one day we're training and they put out for a search warrant and you put in manpower if you're available. So they put out a second one saying any more people. So I was like, I'll do it. I'll breach. And, his name was Eric Englehart, was putting the op order together. He's like, okay. And I thought he was shitting me. And then I get the alert that I'm on the warrant. And I'm like, fuck, I'm not even clear for duty. But I needed it. Like, that was the biggest question I had when I woke up. Could I still do it? If you put me in front of a door, will I freeze or will I do it? So that night was a rough night. I didn't sleep. And I showed up. Our report time is 4 a.m. And of course, it's the farthest drive from where we have to be. And normally everyone's like joking and stuff until we're about, you know, a minute out and everyone's serious. But it was real quiet. I remember it was eerily quiet. You hear a pin drop. I was sweating. I was like, someone got to open a door. And when we got to the target and the door opened, everything was just normal. And I got in front of a door, swung a ram, and I didn't make entry because I wasn't cleared for duty. And it was 1,136 days it took me to get in front of that door. And then when it was all over, I get home and I get a phone call from my lieutenant. He's like, are you clear for duty? I'm like, mm-mm. And somehow the Chiefs got wind and they were pretty pissed. And it sparked all kind of meetings and putting people on a carpet. And I was like, I lied. And Eric was like, I knew he wasn't. Like, my team knew I needed that door, so they had my back. And he was like, I'll put you in front of it again. So my commander called me. He was like, I have to have a go meeting with the chief. What's going on? And I was like, listen, what I gained mentally that day, you guys could fire me four times over. It doesn't matter. Like, I needed that door. So he called me like an hour and a half later after the meeting. He was like, I'm going to assume that that's not going to happen again. I'm like, I'm getting surgery in 2 weeks. So no. I went off again with a surgery, skated, but they weren't happy at all.
Are you still married?
Yes.
Good. Good. And you also mentioned one of the victims. You've become very good, close friends with him, haven't you?
Yeah, Dan Lager. He was the one in the hallway. I was at the other end. And nurse came in one day and was like, hey, one of the survivors is on her. He wants to meet you. It's his goal for physical therapy to come meet you. And I'm like, okay. And I was always surrounded by somebody. They actually signed three people to me and guard on my door. So they made sure that I was never alone. And I just happened to be alone that day. And I hear like a walker clicking down. And here comes this old man. And I remember looking at him and I'm like, man, that's one tough old man. You know, I'm like, I can't let him show me up.
How old was he?
He was 70 when he got shot. So I was obviously bedridden for a long time, but I was like, man, if he could do it. And the city gave me a Medal of Valor, and I mailed it to him and explained to him why I felt he deserved it more than me. And he was a huge motivation to me. So he actually asked me, he was like, do you mind if I, donate this to the, we have a little history museum and Jewish people have a section. And I was like, man, it's yours to do what you want with, And he was like, how about the letter? And I'm like, that letter is kind of personal, but whatever you want to do. So I went with him for the signing it over to the museum, and he decided to keep the letter to himself, which I'm good with.
Who would have ever thought that would be? I'm sure that was a very motivating factor for you in your recovery, is the fact that here's a 70-year-old man that, suffered some of the same things you did, and here he's walking down on a walker just to see you. That's got to be cool.
But that's what I told him, like, why? Like, I trained for that moment. You didn't, I mm-hmm. trained my whole career for that moment. You just went to worship at 70 years old. And, that's, to me, more impressive than someone who trained for that moment.
Good stuff.
Hey, well, let's not get away from this too fast, because you also received some national awards too. Tell us about that. You said the president visited you?
Yeah, the president came to the hospital, and then he brought me to the State of the Union, and me being a dumb breacher from McKees Rocks, my buddy's like, hey, you got an invitation, you can't say no, you're going to State of the Union. I'm like, I don't even know what the State of the Union is. I didn't. So he's like, it's like a big deal. I'm like, all right, I guess I'm going. And that was actually the first time I stood and I wasn't allowed. I was still in a wheelchair. So when I went to my next doctor's appointment, I heard about that a little bit, but I'm like, I didn't.
Of course, you were on television. You got a shout out too.
Well, that, and there was a bunch of WW2 vets. So every time I met one, I stood up, and my friends were looking at me. I'm like, you don't shake their hand sitting down like what they did. I'm going to stand up. So that was literally
good for you.
Good for you. I appreciate that too. My dad, besides being a Vietnam vet, was a World War II vet. So damn few of those.
And also.
Damn few of those people from the Greatest Generation left. What was it like being at the State of the Union?
Humbling. Because again, I just did my job. You know what I mean? Like, I signed up for it. I knew the risks. I trained for it. I did my job, and here I am at this State of the Union, and he goes through the thing, and I get a standing ovation. I'm like, man, this is pretty humbling. Like, in my mind, I just did what I was supposed to do. Like, nothing more, nothing less, nothing really noteworthy. Like, that's what we do,
Well, it's not every day you get shot 11 times. It's not every day that, here's the other thing too. You're talking about, the guy, George, right? You've become friends with
Dan.
I'm sorry, Dan. But that day to you, Dan was just another person. He was like, you're not my problem, right? You're moving on, right? See, to me, that's such an amazing thing, is that you go from, you see something, but you assess it real quick and you say, not my problem, and you move on. And that's kind of the last thought you give it. Cause once you move on, it's somebody else's problem, right?
Right. We get together probably once a month, drink bourbon, beer, get food. Through trial, I hung out with all the families, and it kind of accepted me, and they're like, your family now. So it's, I don't know. I'm more emotionally invested, I guess, in it now, meeting all the families and hanging out with them for 3 months. And, I've gone to functions with the families and stuff, and it's.
Have you learned to say oy vey yet?
I did not, but I did go one of their things, and I'm like, man, 3 hours is long. I mean, you could sit down, though. It's not like going to Catholic where you got to kneel, stand. They just talk and stuff. I don't know. It was different, but yeah. I had to wear an honorary yarmulke because you have to have a head covering. I didn't know.
I was in Jerusalem here back actually 2019, went to the Western Wall, and that's what you do. You get a yarmulke. Everybody's got to wear one. But It was very humbling to go to the Western Wall to talk with some of the folks there. I mean, such a history. What are you doing now? So you get the recovery, 2 years of recovery, but you're still not 100%. So what are you doing now?
Contemplating, moving on from it, finding another path. It's a hard decision, but I talked to, my union and stuff. I think it's time to walk away. City don't know that yet, so don't say nothing until next month. But I think I'm going to go.
Well, we won't put anything out. If we have to, you know, we'll leave this in, but we'll edit it out if you need us to do it as well, too. So, what's led you to this decision?
I hit the door. My motivation was to get to that door, to get the answer. Physically, I'd probably say I'm 70%, so I could wind up a liability. Mentally, I'll go through a door with my team any day. Just the physical, it is definitely getting harder with each surgery. The 26th one beat me up. You know, I'm like, when's this going to end? So,
But if you punch out, you get, what kind of medical retirement do you get out of this?
It'll be better than my normal pension. So that's kind of, was a deciding factor too. Once I heard the numbers, I'm like, well, I have my 20 next year. I could technically retire, but I'm not going to fight the city. They kind of were putting a squeeze on me before trial. To take a disability or fill out ADA, all this weird stuff. And I was like, you really going to start this shit 2 weeks before trial? And I got into it with them pretty good. And honestly, and you can put this on, the only thing that got them off my back is I said, after trial, people's going to want to interview me and I'm going to air all this dirty laundry. And I was on the phone and literally the next words were, we are handling this wrong. And they kind of left me alone, but they were squeezing me before trial, which I don't.
Yeah. Yeah. So if you do go, do you have any plans of what you want to do next?
Not yet. Been looking at different avenues, you know, trying to throw some feelers out there, but nothing definite.
So we wanted to finish out one thing, Murph. So get your blood pressure medicine. The governor.
Yeah. So,
go ahead.
Apparently, that death warrant and stuff. And after, I don't know how many days after, but I was in there and the mayor and the governor wanted to come see me. And I don't really like them. And I was like, I don't want to see them. And the one chief was like, what? And I was like, I don't want to see them. And my teammates were like, well, he spoke, so they're not coming in. So they didn't let him in the room to see me. And then I saw Trump a couple of days later. But I kind of got voluntold a couple of weeks later that Peduto's coming. I was our mayor at the time, and he has to come in. They kind of were like, yeah, you're going to see him. But, yeah, in my opinion, if he would have signed that death warrant, I would have saw him. But he wouldn't sign it, so I'd have no news for him.
Why would he not sign a death warrant on somebody like this who killed 11 people, wounded seven, including
him? He wouldn't sign a death warrant on Poplawski, the one that killed the three officers.
Oh, okay. I got it.
All right. What was the governor's name?
Wolf. Tom Wolf.
So he wouldn't sign the death warrant on somebody who killed three of your buddies?
Correct.
Why? He just not a believer in the death penalty, or he just is this another one of these anti-cop bullshit moves?
I know the mayor's was anti-cop. That's why I didn't want to see him, but I don't know what Wolf's deal was. I don't know why you wouldn't just sign that paper, but yeah, I ain't got no. How are you going to come in my room and act like you care about police when you won't sign that paper?
That's exactly right. Exactly right. Well, I bet if he'd been shot at or one of his family members had been shot at, it might have been a different story. What do you think?
I say that all the time. Once someone they know becomes a victim, I bet you their attitude changes.
Let me tell you, I guarantee it does. People who were, I don't like that. And all of a sudden, when they become a victim of crime, then it's like these members of Congress. I live in Northern Virginia. Oh, this is bad. Then they get carjacked. It's like, why aren't the police doing more shit? Well, because you defunded them and there's not enough cops out there. Right. So you can't have it both ways.
No.
And for our listeners, you know, we stay apolitical on here, but we're not talking politics here. We're talking somebody.
I didn't mention a party. Position. I mean,
right.
Either I just get tired of politicians talking out of their mouth. And then there are consequences when you take budget away and you make priorities. Don't tell me what your priority is. I know what your priority is. It's the ones you fund. When you don't fund something, it's not a priority. So very easy way to figure it out. All right. Before I go off on a rant, go ahead.
I got to say one more thing. Our listeners know we're pro-police, we're pro-military, we will continue to be. If you're new here on Game of Crimes and you don't approve of that, this is not the podcast for you. You'll hear some tales of heroic bravery that you will not hear anywhere else. You'll hear people just like we got today, Tim sacrificing himself for his team, for people he never met. And look what he's going through now. These are life long issues he's got to deal with because he saved people that he'd never met before. So if you're not with us and you're not bleeding blue, you're not bleeding green, you're not supporting our police and military, please move on. We've got no time for you.
G. Murph, that's an exciting note to end up on.
I just want to make sure my point's clear.
I think it was clear. It was definitely clear.
We need to up your dosage of Metamucil. That'll help clear things out.
I might need to go change my Depend again here. I don't know. Something crawling up my ass right now.
Hey, well, look, I can't tell you, first of all, it's an honor to meet you. And for what you did, I mean, this, people can't see this, but this is us saluting you for your service to your community, your service to our country. And you know what the biggest thing for me, the biggest takeaway is you want to stay in the game. I mean, it's like this didn't deter you from doing it. It's like it even made you more determined to say, hey, I want to stay in the game. That's why we need more cops like you. Yep. Maybe a little bit lighter so we don't have to drag their ass around like so that.
They don't get thrown on stairs.
Yeah. Or when you break a stair and you're laying on your back and you're fucked and your buddies are walking past you, it's like, Jesus Christ, here we go again.
Fat ass.
There's Turtle on the ground again.
There's Turtle.
Can I tell him the weed story before we go?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
So this gets into mental health. And to this day, the city has never checked on my mental health. When I got home, no, they have not. At no point has the city checked on my mental health.
When you say city, are you including the police department in that, or is that two separate things?
No, I'm talking to the department.
Okay.
So when I got home and he heard the story, and this, I tell the story, and people's reached out to me, so I feel it's important. So when I got out of hospital, I was in hospital for 16 weeks. I had to learn to walk again and stuff. So I'm all beat up. I'm still non-weight bearing. I could walk on one leg, on my right leg, and I have a crutch. And I'm at home. I finally get home. I had to stay in my buddy's basement for an additional 6 weeks because there's stairs to get to my house. So I was in a real bad place, you know, detoxing and everything. So I get up one day and I'm like, I'm just going to end this. You know what I mean? I can't do this no more. I'm going to tap out. So I go outside and, my buddy, I've known him since kindergarten. He's on a job. At some point, weed whacked. So I call this thing a weed, but it's actually a piece of hedge. And I'm a fisherman. So there was a minnow bucket. And when he weed whacked, a piece of this hedge fell in. So I'm walking by this minnow bucket and I'm choked up and, you know, thinking of how I'm going to do this. And I look in this minnow bucket and there's a weed. And at some point it rained and this weed grew one root. And I looked at that weed and I was like, man, that's one tough fucking weed. I said, somebody tried to kill it. Nobody cared about it. And it found a way to survive all by itself. And then I reflected on myself. I'm like, I have the biggest support system that anyone could ask for. My teammates, my friends, my family, complete strangers from across the world sending me letters, you know, and I'm like, man, you know, basically you're being a baby. It's time to go to work, you know? And that was the day I really committed to, you know, pushing it in PT. Well, I took that weed and I kept water in the bucket and the weed grew a good root bed. And I bought some potting soil and that weed is on my front porch today. It grew some friends. And I see that every day when I get up and leave my house and every day when I come home, there's that weed is a reminder, you know, and I mean that I have support. So I started going to happy school, seeing a psychologist. I go regularly. I know it's taboo in our field, you know, but I wish I would have did it years ago. But yeah, I'm a big proponent of if I could go to happy school, you know, I'm sure anybody can.
Well, we've talked about this. That's why I said I'm glad we got into this. I mean, I've lost more friends to suicide that were on the job than actually being killed on the job. You know, suicide, it's just like with the military. It's time that it quits being this taboo subject. You don't talk about it. Final thought, when you walked out, how close were you to pulling the trigger?
Well, I was just outside. And again, I was on one crutch. I didn't really have it. How I was going to do it, I just knew I was going to do it.
You were in the planning stage at that point. Mm-hmm. All right.
You know,
wow.
God works in mysterious ways, brother. I mean, who would have ever thought just a stray weed in a bucket would change your life the way it has?
Yeah.
Well, I got to tell you, after you said ketamine and you said about the weed story, I thought you were talking about Token Up or something. It's like, I got five.
Hey, right. He told us, Tim told this story in South Carolina, man. And let me tell you, it brought a lot of tears to a lot of
eyes. I tell you what, I'm still got goosebumps. I've got, you know, I got my, of course, my Tommy Bahamas, you know, pullover on, but man, it's like, but I still got chills.
Hey, Tim, how many articles of clothing do you have that are from Tommy Bahama?
Not a single one.
I'm with you, brother. Oh, wait a minute. I do have a Tommy Bahama umbrella we use on the beach.
Yeah, clearly not enough, my friend. Clearly not enough. You uncultured heathens, you. At least they didn't find me on my fucking back like a turtle, you know?
I just found out you have to drink beer out of fancy glasses. I didn't, who would have known?
It makes a difference. I tell you what, it makes a difference.
Hey, man, this is, you know, thank you so much, Tim. I mean, it's.
Thank you for having me.
Just finishing up, and you call it happy school. I've never heard it referred to going to this counselor like that.
I'm glad we cleared up the weed thing, too, because my mind was going, I was trying to say, how am I going to make a story about this? Gummies? What are we, you know? Anyway, dude, that is, you know what? But again, it's one of those things. I think what it was, this is me doing your dime store psychoanalysis. You were talking about doing it, but I don't think you were really committed to doing it. And when you saw that weed, that's what for you, you were looking for a way, how do I save myself? You know? And sometimes it's people, it's serendipity, you know, it's divine intervention with you. It's just, you saw that in there and it's kind of like, I think for you, that's what it was, is that you were saying, I want to do this because you wanted the pain to go away, right? But it was like, but you saw that in there. And I think in your mind, you said, yeah, but not today's not the day, you know? So I'm glad because we wanted you here to tell the story. People got to hear what guys like you do for people like us. And I can't tell you how much we appreciate it.
Absolutely, brother. Thank you, guys, you know what? You ever have those thoughts again? I know you got teammates there. You got brothers and sisters there, but you've got two here that you can call anytime, my friend.
Appreciate it.
Unless you make fun of my beer glasses or my Tommy Bahama, then it's like, Tim, who?
That will be continue as long as this podcast goes on. That's going
to
continue.
Well, and speaking of going on, this one has to come to a close, right? So you don't go anywhere. You guys can hang on real quick. Everybody else, stay tuned for the debrief. You know, where do you go with a story like this? I mean, it's like, and so by now you've heard the story. Go take a look at the picture. He sent the picture, a weed. Mm-hmm. His ability to look at a weed and go, if that son of a bitch can survive, so can I, you know?
Absolutely. And I mean, just think about this, a simple weed. He was walking out of his house to go commit suicide. He was trying to plot it out, how he was going to do it. And he simply saw a sprig of a bush, or he calls it a weed, that had fallen in a pot, got a little bit of water, a little bit of soil, and was regenerating itself. And that was his motivator. I mean, you know, whether you believe in God or not, that's up to you. You know, God gave us free will to make our own decisions. But if that wasn't a miracle, I don't know what was. I was getting ready to say it was a miracle. It's miraculous because it was a miracle.
It was. And look, but you think about this. You're walking into a place with the guy, and he had definitely, you know, prepared for this. He was trying to set an ambush up. You know it's an ambush. You know he's got the tactical advantage, and yet mm-hmm. you still got to push forward. You still got to go in and face the danger, face the evil, because if you don't do it, then who's going to do it?
Right. You know, and I got mixed feelings about, I mean, the perp here got shot up pretty good, not good enough. But sometimes when the perpetrator is killed, you think, well, that's not justice because he doesn't get to suffer like he made everybody else suffer. So, yeah. You know, in this particular case, I'm kind of okay with the perpetrator living, knowing that he's been sentenced to death.
Well, let's just hope the governor doesn't wuss out this time like you find out. That's the other thing, too.
It's federal this time.
It's federal this time, yeah. Oh, that's right. Yeah, it's federal this time. So let's hope that they follow through on that. Because like we talked about in the episode, it's rare that you get a federal death sentence. Not that many cases go to a federal death sentence. Timothy McVeigh was one of them, the Oklahoma City bombing, you know, as an example. So, but I'm just disgusted too and disheartened by the way the city has treated him after the shooting. Here's a guy who gave of himself, gave of his body. And it's just like he's just kind of being left out there.
Yeah, his brothers took care of him. now I'm trying to see if we can arrange for some events for him to speak at, to tell his story, because he's going to be looking for a job here.
Everybody does eventually, so yeah.
Yeah. Tim, brother, thank you so much for coming on the show and being so open and honest and transparent about your whole story. The suffering that you went through and
what did he say, 27 surgeries?
I think so. And the way you handled the governor. I love it.
You know, reminds me of another governor who got handled by when they were told don't show up to the funeral.
Uh-huh. Recently.
She showed, yeah, that and the Attorney General, Letitia James, and Governor Kathy Hochul were turned away from Officer Jonathan Diller's funeral up there in New York. And they were told, don't show up. They did. And you know what? I'm glad. New York, too, is a special place, but I'm glad to see those guys stuck to their guns. And they said, Dad, we don't want you here. We don't care who you are.
Well, and that's what happened here in Tim's case. His brothers in arms took care of him, continued to look out for him. The city, not so much.
Yeah.
So Pittsburgh, you could do better.
You can do better. Come on. All right. Well, hey, look, that brings an end to this. And guys, I'm telling you, you don't hear stories like that except right here. And we had a hard time getting him. You can kind of tell he was a little reserved at first, but then we get going and he gives me a ration of shit, which, you know, that's my job is to bring that out of people. You two ganged up on me too, by the way.
I don't know what you're talking about.
I do.
I have no recollection of that, Your Honor.
Well, let me refresh your recollection, as they say. Well, guys, well, we hope you enjoyed that podcast. Again, you want to talk about heroism on display. That's it. And all the guys on the SWAT team and all the people who responded that day, this is us saluting you. Thank you guys.
Absolutely.
For defending and protecting America and freedom. So if you guys like that, go over to Apple, hit those, and Spotify, hit those 5 stars. You can leave comments on Spotify. We hope that you do. Head on over to Game of Crimes podcast. You'll see the picture of the weed that he talked about that he still waters and cultivates to today.
Mm-hmm.
Follow us on that thing they call social media at Game of Crimes on Twitter, Game of Crimes on podcast, and the Instagram. Also, head on over to Game of Crimes fans. Type that into your Facebook search utility. You'll come into our fan page run by our favorite mafia queen, Sandy Salvato, rules with the iron fist with the velvet glove. Guys, just answer a couple questions, be deemed worthy of admittance, and you too shall receive the benefits of being inside the inner sanctum when we have all of these fun things, right? And then the fun thing was we just got through doing our Patreon. Patreon.com/gameofcrime. And even Murph could solve a couple of these 911 calls.
They were the first. That first one, I loved it.
You know,
there's policemen trying to pull me over. He's got lights and he's got a gun. Well, you think?
Yeah, most cops do in America, man. Most cops do. Yes. Just,
you bet.
I'm only going 20 miles an hour. Yeah. Well, that was after going 110.
Yeah.
So that may be why you're getting pulled over. But if you want to know more, patreon.com/gameofcrime. So, guys, we can't tell you how much we appreciate you guys listening. Give us your feedback, leave your comments. And we want to thank, as you guys can see today, this should tell you that this is one of the most dangerous games of all. So thank you guys for playing the biggest, baddest, most dangerous game of all, the Game of Crimes.